In Michael's book, Slave Species of God, he also draws clear and startling analogies between new discoveries in genetic engineering and ancient archaeological finds. We'll talk about that and much more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, let's talk a little bit, if we can, because you are right. We are going to move into some controversial territory here. But it is strange to me that the story of the Anunnaki and the fact that they came down to this planet and then they started to genetically alter what was on this planet, and then we became the humans we are now. The biblical stories talk about fallen angels breeding with the, you know, the daughters of man. I've got to ask you if you believe that's the story here that we're beginning to uncover with this species, this race that came down to our planet. I mean, they came down. It could be construed that they were fallen angels. Is this one and the same?
You know, fallen angels is an interesting tag or name for them. I have my own theory on the angels, which I'd like to get to a bit later. But just to dive right into the deep end, and by George, you are opening a can of worms now, you know.
Yes, we are. Okay. Here we go.
Genesis 6, verse 1 to 4 says, "When men began to increase on earth and daughters were born to them, the divine beings saw how beautiful the daughters of men were and took wives from among those that pleased them. The Lord said, 'My breath shall not abide in man forever, since he too is flesh. Let the days allowed him to be 120 years.' It was then and later too that the Nephilim appeared on earth, when the divine beings cohabited with the daughters of men who bore them offspring. They were the heroes of old, men of renown." Now, you know, those are some very hard to swallow words that come straight out of Genesis, the Old Testament. Now, what's fascinating is that the exact same story is written in greater detail in the Sumerian tablets. Now, for those that haven't studied the Sumerian tablets, once you actually delve into it and you start looking at the volume of work there that is captured for future generations like us, it becomes absolutely evident that most of the stuff written in the Old Testament has been taken out of the Sumerian tablets and edited and put into some different kind of context for the generation of that particular time. And I have no doubt in my mind that the settlers on earth, the Anunnaki, as we call them, gods, our creators, the creators of this new species called Homo sapiens, that they did start having sex and interbred with the species that they created. You know, after all, the human race was a beautiful race 200,000 years ago already. The women were gorgeous, as they are today. If you were a young son of a superior being that was on earth, and you saw a gorgeous, girl by the river, wouldn't you get excited about that?
Yeah, I guess I would.
Exactly. And that's when the trouble began. Now suddenly you had offspring that were half gods and half mortal or half human, and various arguments began to erupt. And that's where the interesting Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the most studied ancient historical documents, the Epic of Gilgamesh, who believed Gilgamesh, who was a king, who believed who was half god and half human, who wanted to be bestowed the same privileges as the gods. And he went in search of immortality. Unfortunately, the story didn't end very well for him, but it's a beautifully well-documented ancient historic document that talks about these half-bred humans.
Well, and they also talk about making man, going back just a little bit, in his own image, which is what they did, isn't it?
Yeah, very clearly Sumerian tablets talk about how they attempted, as I mentioned earlier, how they attempted to create this new species, and when they eventually got it right, and the new offspring, the new species, looked the way they wanted it to look, he made a sound like a human, which meant he could talk. And they, you know, the translations say that how Enki held the child up, saying, "I have done it. I have created him in my own image." Yeah.
If the story, Michael, is correct, then I've got to ask you about the story of Lucifer. Who in the heck was he? When we talk about fallen angels, maybe being misconstrued for these ancient astronauts. Who was this person?
Okay, I would take Lucifer as being the devil. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
He may have been an ancient astronaut, right?
Absolutely. Now, this is a really interesting story, and I love this part of the research, and Zechariah Sitchin has written about it, and I've delved a little bit deeper into it. And what is really fascinating, I mean, you know, the ancient symbol of medicine are the two entwined snakes that form a... you know, that sort of wrap around each other.
Yeah.
So that has been the symbol of medicine for as long as man can remember. Now, incidentally, that is also the symbol for Enki or his son Ningirsida, who were according to the tablets, the creators of the human race, of Homo sapien, who actually did the genetic engineering and spliced the DNA together to create the new species. Their symbols were the entwined serpent. For the symbolism, I'm not sure why that symbolism arose. My feeling is that one of the first, or if not the first creature that these astronauts, which was Enki, encountered on Earth when he arrived on this planet, was a serpent. And that was obviously an image that was forever imprinted in his mind.
I see.
And he must have referred to it on many occasions, and that became his symbol on this planet. Now, being the creator of mankind with that symbol of the serpent, an interesting thing happened, that once they managed to create the human race, or Adam, and they put Adam into the Garden of Eden with Eve, which happened sometime later, should I say, she was created sometime later, as we discussed, out of Adam's rib or Adam's DNA. And they put them into this garden to really observe these two new species, these creatures. They wanted to see how they got on, how they procreated, and would they procreate? And what the fascinating thing is that they couldn't procreate. They observed them and they just couldn't procreate. At which point they took them back and they introduced an extra chromosome into their DNA structure. Which was the sex chromosome, because one of the things they didn't do in the first place, when they cloned this female species, they didn't give her a sex chromosome. And that is fascinating. Again, you know, how could these ancient Sumerian tablets have so much detail and know so much about genetics?
Well, and you know what? That was genetics of hundreds of thousands of years ago. We're just starting to get that kind of genetics today.
Yeah, I mean, you in the United States, you have a number of pet cloning firms that have already opened their doors. You know, if your dog dies, they clone you a new one. Now, because we can clone species, and I bet you somewhere in some laboratory somewhere they're cloning humans, we're just not aware of it. Does that make us God? I don't think so.
It shouldn't, but it all depends on through whose eyes they may be looking at us.
Exactly. I think to the species and to the creature, you will be their God. Now, that's exactly what happened to us humans on this Earth. We were created by this advanced race of astronauts that arrived here for very dubious reasons. I would highly question their moral ethics and their laws of human rights that they had in their days when they created this new human race. You know, we can do it today. My question that I pose in the book is, what happens to us on Mars? Let's say, 20 years from now, when we've actually got a small colony on Mars and they need to expand the organization and the activity on Mars, what are we going to do? Are we going to wait 3 years every time we can send them like a shipload of more people to Mars? Or are we going to allow them to clone humans on Mars with specific DNA so that they can grow quicker, mature quicker, and then perform the functions that that they need.
Good point. Good point indeed. And all of this, of course, brings me to this question. How did the Sumerians know this on events that had occurred thousands and thousands of years before this? And I would assume these ancient astronauts were long since gone. How did the Sumerians carry the story? How did they put it on their tablets? What happened?
Well, you know, the Sumerian civilization, as we know, it seems to be the oldest civilization that we know of as of now. And from them, we have basically attained most of the knowledge that we have in our so-called civilized world today. But, you know, they didn't have paper. They didn't have computers as we have computers today. They had different lifestyle. It was a different world, different place. Instead of writing with a pen and paper, with pen on paper, they wrote with a chisel and hammer or sticks on soft clay tablets, which were then hardened and kept for posterity. And there were all kinds of scribes. The Sumerians had scribes coming out of their ears. You know, they had scribes around every corner. School scribes, court scribes, scribes that captured wedding ceremonies or espousal ceremonies and so forth. And then you had royal scribes. As the higher you climbed up the ladder, the more important a scribe you were. And everything that they knew was captured in clay tablets. And the Sumerian tablets refer constantly to a time before time from where they get their information, from when the gods ruled and the gods decreed and bestowed all kinds of things to man and gave man knowledge of agriculture and civilization and domestication of animal and planting crops and all these things. So the Sumerian tablets seem to have had, or the authors of the Sumerian tablets seem to have had their knowledge from much earlier sources. The Sumerian king list is probably, it's a large clay tablet, sort of square-shaped. And it's probably, in my opinion, the most important historic document that we have. You know, it cites about 142 names of kings that can be traced back to, 220,000 years.
Oh, my. Well, what do you think the gap is, Michael, from the beginning of those tablets to when the Anunnaki left this planet, if they ever did leave? I mean, do you think they left, or might they still be here, or their offspring?
Oh, that's a great question. I love that one. It's what I'm asked all the time. I have no idea. My guess is that there's still some descendants of the Anunnaki here. And, you know, there are some great authors that delve into the area of conspiracy theories and support their books with a lot of evidence and so forth. David Icke is probably the most famous one of them all. And, you know, his research is superb, and it's hard to argue against. You got to be a real cynic and really angry with everything around you to want to fight that. But what's interesting is that I truly believe that where there's a conspiracy, there's like smoke, and where there's smoke, there must be a potential fire. And you know, if we look at the control of global events today, I wouldn't be surprised if some remaining Anunnaki were still on Earth and pulling the purse strings.
Or at least their genetic line, huh?
Exactly, the genetic offspring. That's how I would see it. You know, let's think of it this way. How much do we know about the decisions that get made in the boardrooms of the giant corporations of the world? Microsoft, you know, IBM, the companies that influence our daily lives in ways that we can't even comprehend. What do we know about what goes on behind those closed doors and how they plan their, you know, the next month's activities and how they're going to control the world with their technology? We know nothing about that, and we never will.
Can't well, genetically, Michael, genetically, would Anunnaki direct offspring, would they be different than the genetic offspring that was created thousands of years ago? So let's assume that this planet evolved into two different directions. One was the genetic human beings that they made, and then, you know, we went off and became who we are. And then there was the Anunnaki bloodline. If we were to take DNA of them and compare it to DNA of other people on this planet, would it be different?
My guess is they would probably be very similar, mostly because if we look at our DNA, our DNA is an interesting molecule. It's our DNA, you know, we only use about 3%, if that much, 3% of our DNA. The rest is what geneticists call junk DNA. So 97% of our DNA is absolutely useless. It has no impact or effect on us at all. Only 3% of the DNA has what we call exons that are active genes that are coded for something that controls you, your physical being. And so what is that 97% of the DNA for? My feeling is that much of that DNA is probably the remaining DNA of the original Anunnaki DNA that was switched off or disabled somehow to create this lesser intelligent primitive sort of working species or slave species of the early gods.
Good point. Yeah. Well, if they've got their other 97% working at full capacity, they must be very sophisticated compared to us.
Yeah, look, that's an interesting debate as well, because now you start comparing or getting into the debate of nurture versus nature and evolution versus creation. Because, you know, remember, they also come from some planet somewhere. And at some point, they must have also evolved or been created by a similar set of circumstances that we were created.
That's true. And eventually, if you do believe in that divine creator, that everything has got to lead back to that godlike figure eventually.
Absolutely. And the Anunnaki talk about that very specifically. In the Sumerian tablets, they refer to the creator of all and how they start getting deliberating about the moral issues, about creating humans or creating a new species on this planet Earth. They debate that extensively, you know, debating the moral issues behind it, whether they should create a new species or shouldn't. And that's fascinating. It's all fascinating stuff that leads back to God with a small g as opposed to God with a big G.
Well, this planet that Zechariah Sitchin talked about was called Nibiru, and it comes around every 3,600 years on a very long elliptical orbit. Do you believe that that planet is still in existence? And if so, do you have any idea when it's going to get close again?
That's probably the second most popular question that people email me. I think we're all dying to find another planet in our solar system with some sort of intelligent beings on it that we can communicate with. I mean, but yes, I mean, Nibiru has become famous made by Zechariah Sitchin, and much of the most latest astronomical findings and discovery is corroborating his theories from 25 years ago on a daily basis. You know, if I said to you just over a year ago that, you know, there are more than 9 planets in our solar system, you would have laughed at me. Suddenly,
yeah, I probably would have. Well, except I've got this inquisitive mind because I believe there's more than they've even found.
Yeah, exactly. Now, suddenly, a year ago, you know, our astronomers and our scientists make the startling discovery that, look at this, we've suddenly discovered evidence that there are many more planets in our solar system, not just the 9 that we are aware of. And isn't that just fascinating? But, you know, the Sumerians were writing about these planets a long time ago. They have been translated by people like Sitchin and others, and for many years being laughed at and ridiculed. But now suddenly modern science comes along and corroborates that evidence from thousands of years ago on these clay tablets. And, okay, well, now since our new scientists have corroborated this, we'll believe it. Now, why can't we believe at face value that what is written in the Sumerian tablets has a large element of truth in it and start behaving accordingly or start using that evidence to look for new clues about our origins and about what's happening around our cosmos?
I agree, Michael. Even if 10% of what the Sumerian tablets say are correct and accurate, that's enough for us to investigate. Well, stay with us. We're going to come right back. We'll continue this discussion. And I also want to ask you about the possibility of a nuclear war that might have occurred here a long time ago, because archaeologists have discovered glass-like material which could only have been created by a nuclear explosion. I'm not going to say it was a bomb, but it could have been an asteroid or something else that created that. But let's get your take on that. And then at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines. It'll be your turn. I'll be back. Okay, just hold on. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. Not yet. Not yet. Back in a moment with our guest, Michael Tillinger, on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, archaeologists have found what could be remains, remnants of some kind of nuclear explosion that occurred a long, long time ago. They have found sheets of glass that could only have been formed by some kind of an explosion. I don't know what it was. Could have been an asteroid, could have been anything. But doesn't Zechariah Sitchin talk about the fact that there were nuclear explosions, that there were wars between the Anunnaki, and that possibly this is what could have happened?
Absolutely. Zechariah Sitchin talks about him and about this as possible situation, but the Bible is very clear about the situation itself. It all depends, I suppose, how the readers of the Bible interpret it. And this is actually one of my most favorite parts of the Bible, because it's just so rich with visual imaginary that the story of Abraham and his nephew Lot and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is absolutely fascinating. One of the amazing things that I find is that, you know, the Old Testament is full of interaction between God and humans. Not just interaction in prayer, but physical interaction, where God comes down and sits down and has some food and wine and water with various humans, and normally accompanied by one or two angels, and then they discuss various things. And in this particular instance with Abraham, God came down and met Abraham accompanied by two angels, and they sat in his tent and they drank some, and they had some food and water and wine, if I'm not mistaken, and then God asked Abraham about, you know, this conspiracy against God by these evil, violent, evil people in Sodom and Gomorrah. And now, first of all, I find it fascinating that God would have to ask Abraham if there was a conspiracy against him by the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, surely God would know this. Secondly, the fact that God then instructed or asked Abraham to tell him that there is at least 1 or 50 righteous people there, and then he'll save Sodom and Gomorrah. And what you start reading in the subtext is that, you know, they had a plan of action here, God and these two angels. And by God, I mean God with a small g, which I believe to be one of the Anunnaki. Sure. and his two henchmen with fierce weapons that are, you know, described in the Bible and also in great detail in the Sumerian tablets. Fierce weapons of destruction that could smite hundreds of people, if not more, at a time. And so what happens next is God says, okay, well, clearly you can't prove to me that there is one righteous person in Sodom and Gomorrah. This is the excuse that I was looking for. I'm going to send my angels in there, and I'm going to destroy these violent, evil people because they are conspiring against me. Now, what these people were conspiring and how they could possibly conspire against an almighty God is also beyond me. I don't quite understand that, you know.
What were they trying to do?
Yeah, what were they trying to do? My take on this is that I believe that those cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and there were more, by the way, in the whole valley that those two cities were in, those people might have been part of an early resistance movement to the gods, to Enlil and his henchmen and Marduk, or whoever these Anunnaki gods and descendants were. They were causing havoc and a lot of hardship and frustration among humankind, and they started forming resistance pockets against the God of vengeance and brutality, which, you know, the Old Testament is full of evidence of. And God didn't like this. This resistance activity going on. He needed to take care of this. But because we're not talking about the God, the supreme being of the universe here, we're talking about an advanced deity with a small g. He needed a spy, a man on the inside. And that man came in the form of Lot, Abraham's nephew, who was planted very specifically to go and live in Sodom and feed back with information to Abraham about the activities and potential conspiracies against God. And this was a wonderful pivotal moment in the early days of the Bible. And remember that Abraham is the founding father of four of the great religions of the world.
Right.
Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and also the Baha'i faith. They all look at Abraham as their founding father. So this is an interesting beginning that all of them should look at and analyze this as deeply as they can. So what happens next is God disappears back into the clouds, and the two angels go and lo and behold, who's waiting for them at the gates of Sodom? Lot is waiting for them.
There he is, exactly.
Yeah, there he is waiting for them. And he takes them to his house. He makes them as comfortable as possible. And before you could count to 10, the house is surrounded by a number of very angry people saying, "We know who you have in sight. We know those two guys have come here to do us harm. We want to bring them out so we can deal with them." And Lot starts to argue with them and say, "No, they're not here to do you harm. Take my 14-year-old daughter instead. Do with her what you want." I mean, these must have been very powerful gods to make a guy want to offer up his 14-year-old daughter. And then eventually they don't sort this problem out, and these two angels come out and they smite all these people around the house, and they basically kill them and make them blind and incapacitate them with these fierce weapons of destruction.
And could have been laser guns or something.
Well, exactly. You know, your guess is as good as mine, but they were certainly some form of advanced technological device that we might know of. I certainly don't, but you know, the military people might know more about that than you and I. They certainly had the capacity to do that. Two guys just wiped out maybe 500 people or how many might have gathered around the house. I don't know. And then they say, "Well, this is the evidence we needed. These are violent, disgusting people, and they conspire against God. We have to destroy them all." And they tell Lot to take his stuff, get all his family out of there, go across the plateau, hide behind the mountains, because they're now going to destroy the city and all the other cities with it, because they're filled with violent, evil people conspiring against God. And you know the story that followed. It's very well documented in the Bible how they destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and the descriptions are so graphic and so incredible that you could only really describe them today as nuclear explosions.
And, do we know where Sodom and Gomorrah is exactly today?
There are certain people that have made claims. I've put them on a map in my book, the latest research that I could find. Where there have been these various, as you said, fragments of glass and melted rock discovered that could have only been done by some astronomical explosion and incredible heat that could certainly come from a nuclear explosion or a comet or an asteroid. Now, we know that that part of the world was not hit in the past 200,000 years by a comet or an asteroid, so it must have been something else.
Is it possible, Michael, that our past civilizations, and I guess the evidence all points toward visitation, but is it possible this planet alone had an advanced civilization that blew itself up, and then we kind of started all over again? Is there any evidence that points to just that?
I must say I haven't delved into that part of the history in this book. I deal more with what we're discussing here, trying to paint a cohesive storyline of the last 200,000 years since the sudden appearance of Homo sapiens. So I try to steer clear of various other distractions, and I suppose what you're talking about is quite possible, because there are other scientists and geologists that are talking about human race being on Earth, or some sort of a descent or ancestor of human race be living on Earth a million years ago already, and showing skeletal evidence of that, and etc. I haven't really delved into that. mostly focusing on our species for the past 200,000 years.
We know that humankind of thousands of years ago, some of them lived to very high yearly numbers, you know, Methuselah and others as well. Could it be that they were the Anunnaki and they had a very long life span?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the DNA earlier and how it all related to the Anunnaki or the mythological gods, if some people want to call them
sure.
that. They certainly seem to have had a much longer lifespan, if not an eternal lifespan, based on what is written in the tablets. They looked at time completely differently to how we view time. And in that little passage I read to you from Genesis earlier, it also made it clear that God decided to make man's years 120 because he felt that he didn't want man to live longer than that. So again, it points to some sort of genetic manipulation so that man or the newly created Homo sapien species did not live as long as their maker, the Anunnaki gods. And I think the Sumerian tablets are filled with that kind of evidence. I'm just looking here at a Sumerian tablet that was discovered relatively recently. And again, corroborating a lot of what Zechariah Sitchin has been doing for years and being laughed at by many, corroborating all of his work. And this is, again, another thing that people must realize is that Sumerian tablets are being transcribed all the time. It's not something that has happened in the past and put away and there we have it.
There are some, though, who do not, you know, they have interpreted these tablets as being different than what Zechariah Sitchin has. So you are correct when you say there are some skeptics out there who don't accept his theories.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would invite those skeptics to do more reading, more scratching, more of their own research. You know, if you are a skeptic, do your own research and just get on the internet. We have the luxury of having the internet, and you will find so much information, it'll spin your head around for a long time to come. I mean, you know, as I said, you know, Sumerian tablets get transcribed all the time, so and they end up in museums and in different shows around the world. One of the ones that I'm looking at here is a translation that this comes from the Schoen collection in Norway, and it talks about these kings, you know, that rule for 28,000 years, for 43,000 years. For 36,000 years and so forth, a total of 220,000 years, and they name them. They name the kings, they name where they ruled and who they were. Now, these are incredible things that are corroborated across various tablets and definitely are in line with the genetic findings and the historical findings, the things that we've spoken about now, the events of Sodom and Gomorrah that can only be explained if you start applying modern technology to it. And so forth.
Do we know, Michael, if the Anunnaki also paid a little visit to Mars? Is there any evidence that would suggest that?
Lots of evidence about that. I mean, we now know ourselves from our own personal explorations that Mars did have a living atmosphere. It did have water. Well, it still has frozen water under the poles, but it actually had rivers and lakes. We can see the erosion patterns all over the planet. We can also see that Mars must have been struck by some huge catastrophe that stripped it of its atmosphere or caused the atmosphere to dissipate. So there's definitely, we now know from our own experience that Mars had a living a possible living environment, and the Sumerian tablets talk extensively about Mars being visited by the Anunnaki. They, in essence, actually used it as a stopover on their way to Earth. You know, we find that kind of thing preposterous. But you know, I did a little calculation in my book to say, well, if we had the technology or the ability to take enough fuel or some sort of new energy into space with us, and we could accelerate a spaceship at, you know, normal kind of acceleration that most cars can accelerate at today at 10 kilometers per second per second, it'll take us exactly 4 days to reach Mars.
Well, exactly. But who's to say also that they didn't develop or find wormholes or abilities to bend space-time?
Yeah, you know, those are all things that our scientists and science fiction writers are talking about, you know, and Stephen Hawking is writing extensively about, and others, great scientists like him, are talking about wormholes and traveling through space in ways that we haven't, you know, thought of before. They might have done that, but even in just simple jet propulsion technology. You know, if you accelerate a rocket ship at 10 kilometers per second per second, within 4 or 5 days, you're going to start approaching the speed of light. And then you can get a long way, you know.
When you are at a gathering or a conference or a get-together and you talk about some of these theories, what do people say to you?
Well, you always have the skeptics.
Sure.
The know-it-alls, you know, the guys that just immediately tell you, oh, what a bunch of rubbish you're talking about now, you know, where you get all this rubbish from and that kind of stuff. They're just not prepared to listen, you know, and also people that just, you know, look at your book and they throw it on your face and say, ah, oh, I don't know where you got all this rubbish from. So, and then there are the others who have explored some of this, who might have read some Zachariah Sitchin and some other authors of books in a similar vein, and they love to engage in debate about this. And I find that I believe there's a growing global community of inquisitive people, open-minded people, even many people that are of a religious persuasion that are searching, that are maybe not happy anymore with the explanations that their particular religion is giving them. And they are searching for something new or something more substantial that can fill in some of the holes that they might have been struggling with in their knowledge of our human race on this planet and our road from many thousands or from creation to where we are today.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm stopping. I've got that feedback problem again with you. Go ahead.
No, so you know, it's interesting when I do talk at functions and gatherings. It's predominantly if it's a planned gathering, then it's mostly people who are interested. If it's something that happens spontaneously as a debate around a table, then you normally get various arguments thrown in your face. And then I normally say, look, just go and read this book, and then we'll talk about it later.
You talked about the Vedics. How closely do they echo the Sumerian tablets?
Very closely, if you open your mind a little bit. As I said earlier, the Vedas, or Vedic scripts, are probably the greatest religious written work that shows no division between mythological gods and the activities of humans on Earth. And it's a lot of work. I mean, the Vedic scripts said they're over. I think there's 1,028 of these Vedic scripts, or Vedic poems that exalt and talk about the ancient gods and their interaction with humans, how they smote humans, how they promoted humans, how they copulated with humans, how they punished humans, and also about the wars and the conflicts between these gods themselves. It's absolutely phenomenal that such valuable historical information has not been opened more to a larger global society, and I hope that discussions like this will lead to that.
Well, it's the flying machines, too, that fascinate me. Something was going on this planet a long time ago. There was high technology. There were planes. There were craft flying around.
Absolutely, and the Vedic scripts are full of that, are full of those references to flying vehicles, cars coming out of the sky, landing on Earth. It was the god Tvashtri, or Fashioner, who provided the gods with aerial cars and other mysterious weapons, which appeared as handheld items in ancient Hindu depictions. And among those were a host of others. He created a trident for Rudra. He created fire weapons for Agni, and the bolt of hurling thunder for Indra. And these are all involved and included in the Vedic scripts in phenomenal stories. There's a wonderful translation by R. Dutt, which contains the following. It says that the gods in cloud-borne chariots came to view the scene so fair. Bright celestial cars in concourse sailed upon the cloudless sky. Now, this comes from thousands of years ago. How do you describe this? Another interesting thing, George, is for example, the Akkadian civilization. The Akkadian had a word for flying vehicles, which was Tiarita. Now, why would they have a name or a word for flying vehicles in the vocabulary?
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. Stay with us. We'll be back one final hour. It'll be your turn for phone calls now on Coast to Coast AM.